basically the causal structure of these outcomes can be, in some sense, relative to the observer, can be regarded as relative to the observer. The motivation for my work is basically that often in physics we had ad hoc laws, like, for example, Kepler laws of planetary motion of, or Lorentz transformation for Maxwell equations, that they can be regarded as ad hoc laws in the sense that we know that they are the way they are, but we don't know why. And then they came more basic principles, more basic laws that basically explained why the ad hoc laws were the way they are, they were, and also helped us in deepen our comprehension of nature. So with quantum theory, we have basically the same thing. We have that quantum theory can be regarded as a set of ad hoc laws, since systems are complex, are associated to complex Hilbert spaces, and states are associated to density matrices, and measurements are associated to POVMs, positive operator value measurements, and evolutions are associated to completely positive trace preserving maps, and probabilities are associated via Born's rule. And we don't know, basically, or there is still no consensus among the community of physicists or what basic principles, what basic laws can help us in motivate these ad hoc laws and in deeper our comprehension of nature, in some sense, of the world as we see it. And so much work has been done on this subject. And basically, starting from the early days with quantum logic by Birkhoff, von Neumann, Mackey, and a lot of other people. Of course, all these lists are not exhaustive. And we have realistic interpretations, like the Bohmian interpretations of quantum, the Bohmian theory for the trajectory of particles that are guided by the wave function. We have the multiverse interpretation by Everett. We have several collapsing models by Girardi, Riemann, and Weber, von Neumann, etc. We have consistent histories by approach by James Hartle. We had, and last but not least, we have operationalism, starting from Ludwig, then continuing with the work by Hardy, and with the advent of quantum information, this perspective of operational postulate for quantum theory has been, in some sense, renewed. And Chiribella, Adriano, Pirinotti, Mazanes, Mueller, Bruckner, and many others. Of course, these lists are not exhaustive. And my work here starts from a different approach from all this work. And the main question I would like to address is is, could a foundational principle for quantum theory be formulated questioning the role of causal structure? So what this means? This means that for a very pragmatic point of view, quantum theory is a set of rules that permit us to calculate joint probabilities of outcomes. And so what is the role of causal structure? How this mathematical formalism is related to the fact that you attribute a causal structure to such outcomes that for which we can know only the joint probability distribution. And basically, some work on this subject already exists, and of course, this work is slightly different from the work that I mentioned here. But we can mention in this kind of work, in this kind of works that answer that basically try to question the role of causal structure in quantum theory. We can, of course, cite the work by Hardy in 2006, the work by with the causalized formulation of quantum theory, the work by Leifner and Speckens with the quantum conditional state formalism for quantum theory, and also the work by Orishkov, Costa, and Bruckner, in which they invented another formalism for quantum theory, and they basically show that in this formalism they can be formulated processes for which it cannot be defined a precise causal ordering of events. So my work can be casted in this series of work, and here is the outline of the talk. So I will basically define what causal structure of probabilistic outcomes is in a generic quantum experiment in an operational way. And what operational means it will be clear in the following slide. Then I will state the main result of my talk, and that this result is basically is based on this definition of causal structure for outcomes in generic quantum experiments. And I will show how this result directly leads to stating the principle of relativity of causal structure. That is this idea that the probabilistic outcomes in a quantum experiment can be predicted by different observers assuming different causal ordering for them. Then I give a detailed sketch of the proof of the result, and then I will do a brief speculation. I will speculate about extending the principle of relativity of causal structure from the quantum domain, from the domain in which we have experiments and they are involved quantum systems, and we have devices and probabilistic outcomes happening on devices, to this domain, to the cosmological domain. So in order to go through the first step of my talk, and to define what causal structure of outcomes is from an operational way, in an operational way, we start with few simple examples. And in this example, we have A and B that are that represents two polarizers, and the two on each. So the polarizer analyzes photons, and they have apertures on them, and these apertures let the photons passing through the polarizers. And for each polarizer, we can have two possible outcomes, that for polarizer A are AT and AR, and for polarizer B are BT and BR. And so they mean that the photon let the polarizer the polarizer let the photon be transmitted or reflected. And so we have aperture that we label with as input or output. So here, for example, we have that the aperture of device A is an output, and the aperture of device B is indeed an input. And M is some device, like, for example, a mirror, that permits to the photons that pass first to device A goes out from A and then bounce from the mirror to device B and then enters device B and originate an outcome. And so, for example, we can imagine that the photon does precisely this job. And we can, for example, imagine that two possible outcomes, one of the two possible outcomes on A happen, so for example, AT, and one of the two happen on B, for example, BT, so the photon is transmitted by Bohr polarizer. And we have that AT and BT are two events in space-time such that AT causes BT. AT is in the preparation ensemble AR-AT with probability PAR 1 minus PAR, and this preparation ensemble is represented by a density matrix. BT is an outcome of a measurement, indeed, and this measurement has BR and BT as outcomes, and this measurement is represented by a projective valued measurement, or more generically, a positive operator valued measurement. M is indeed represented by a unitary matrix, or more generally, by a completely positive trace preserving map.
If AT causes BT, why is input?
Input means that the aperture of B is an input, and the system of that passed through B is an input system for B. And this is merely a way to label aperture that basically are associated to what causal structure we assume between AT and BT. And so I will. Yes, the photon goes out from A and enters.
No, I know, but where is the photon created?
The photon is created somewhere.
So there's also an input to A.
There is an input also for A, and there is an output also for B. But here, what matters is the joint probability of the outcomes AT on the outcomes on A. And so basically, what matters for the causal ordering of the two outcomes A and B is that we have this kind of labelings of for the two polarizer A and B. Is this, does it make sense?
So A is before B entirely.
Yeah,
I mean, certainly the labeling suggests the reverse, at least to me.
The photon goes out through the output of A.
Sorry, the photon what?
Leaves through the output of A.
Yeah, I can repeat. Yes, this is the imagine. The photon goes outside and goes inside B.
Okay.
So it is an output system for polarizing A.
I think what you're, in and output are labeling those little gaps there.
Yes.
So exactly. They are the apertures. Yes.
The apertures, yeah.
Okay.
Sorry, maybe the picture is not so clear.
All right. So A spits out a photon, it bounces off the mirror and goes into B.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah. So we label output and input the aperture that of the two polarizers.
And A could have been one of two polarizations. And B,
yeah, of course.
All right. Okay. All right.
Does that make sense? Yes. Yeah. And we can have another situation here where we have the same two polarizers as before and the same two outcomes and the same two possible outcomes on each polarizer. And the aperture now are labeled in a different way. And the aperture are, for example, the aperture of device A is an input aperture, as well as the aperture of device B, it is an input aperture. And since we originate by a joint probability of outcomes on these two devices A and B is originated by M, that is now now represents a source of photons in some bipartite state that start from M and then goes input as inputs inside A and B respectively, and they can originate two outcomes, A, for example, AT and BT on A and B. And so in this experiment, what we have is that AT and BT are two space-like events, and AT is an outcome of a measurement. This outcome is represented by an element of a PVM or a POVM, and BT is another outcome of a measurement that is represented as well as a PVM element or a POVM element. And M is now a generically entangled, because entangled states are more than factorized states, generically entangled bipartite state of the two input system, the two photons. So to generalize these examples, we can say that if we have two devices, A and B, and they happen a set of random outcomes on A, and we call this set X, and the set of random outcomes on B, and we call this set Y. And we have that it happened A0 on A and B0 on B. Then if we assume that the aperture of device A is an output aperture, and the input of, the aperture of device B is an input aperture, then the outcome A0 causes the outcome B0. And on the other end, if we assume that, for example, the aperture of device A is an input aperture, and as well as the aperture of device B, we have that A0 and B0 are two space-like separated events. So what we mean with operational definition of causal structure is basically that the causal structure of the outcomes that happen on the devices in a generic experiment is equivalent to a given input-output structure for the apertures that are on the devices involved in the experiment. So since basically what we have is that any two outcomes that A0, B0 that happen on two devices, A and B, are also events that happen in space-time, what we basically do is that for a situation of the first type in which A0 causes B0, we draw a space-time diagram of the first type here, where A0 causes B0. While for the other situation when A0 and B0 are space-like separated and we have two input aperture, then basically what we have is that the diagram is is as in the second diagram, the space-time diagram for A0 and B0 is as in the second diagram here. And since in this diagram, the time arrow is something that is absolutely fixed, is it a question? Yeah.
Answer it, but can we assume that this diagram is not the real space-time diagram? This is just some abstract diagram showing the causal relations that you
are
imagining.
I don't know what you mean by real, but...
Well, I mean, you couldn't set up an experiment. I don't see how you could set up an experiment in which a mirror was a source of entangled photons, and then you had these two devices that were truly space-like separated with respect to the physical space-time metric and behave the way you're talking about.
So I don't understand the question.
Well, I don't see how, you say operational, although you had it in quotes, I don't see how there could be an operational realization of your second diagram.
So you mean that...
how does that thing at the bottom generate those two red lines, is roughly speaking?
Yes.
Yeah, yes. Is an entangled state. Of course, it's an entangled state of two photons or of two.
But it's just a mirror. There, it's nothing there but a mirror. I mean, could you actually build this in a laboratory?
A source of entangled photons,
which is just a mirror.
I don't know.
You didn't say is this blue line in the bottom diagram? It doesn't have to represent a mirror.
No. Of course. Okay. No. It's just a device that that's put spits away to.
Oh.
So,
I misunderstood. I thought that top and bottom were just two different ways of viewing the same.
Sorry. These are two different experiments. Yes.
So in the top, the blue line is a mirror.
Yeah.
And in the bottom, it's not the mirror.
Yeah, yeah.
It's actually a box or something like that.
Yes. But then the point will be that, of course, it is... the point is that actually, later we will discuss, but basically what I'm going to show is that whatever you assume is for this object being a mirror or a source of generically entangled states, basically these two experiments can be indeed seen as equivalent.
Well, now you're saying you can see them.
Yes. I will say, I'm not saying right now, but I'm going to say yes.
Then I'll ask the question again.
Yes.
When you say
later.
Okay.
Thank you. Okay. So we have these two space-time diagrams, and basically what we have is since this A0 and B0 are two outcomes and also two space-time events, these are the two diagrams that represent the two experiments. Yes.
I'm a bit confused by the top diagram, by the x coordinate. Should the A0 be on the other side? Just comparing with the previous the diagram there, like if x is the horizontal axis.
There is no.
So it's just a causal diagram. It's not
Okay. It's not to be related to, directly related to the peak. I think
the x axis is up and down.
X is up and down. Okay.
Yeah.
Right now it's done.
So, since I was saying, since in these two diagrams, basically, the outcome A0 and B0 have a fixed embedding in space time, and in space time, basically, the time arrow is something that is absolutely fixed. We have that the causal ordering of A0 and B0. Are something that are defined absolutely for every observer. So in every physical process, it is assumed that the causal ordering of events is an absolute property. And basically, this means that all observers of a process agree on whether two events are one the cause of the other, or they are space-like separated. And this means, in our operational language, that input-output structure is regarded as an absolute thing. So this means that every observer in an experiment in which two devices are in which two devices there can appear two sets of random outcomes, X and Y. We assume all observers agree that the aperture of device A is an output aperture, the aperture of device B is an input aperture. So this is something that is absolutely fixed for all of the observers. Now, this is the main result of my talk, and this is what I'm going to talk about. And the result is that in a generic quantum experiment, the input-output structure may be regarded as an observer-dependent property. This means that two observers of the same probabilistic quantum experiment can assume a different input-output structure and predict the same joint probabilities of outcomes. And so basically, if we have these two devices, A and B, and we have, for example, that one observer can assume that the aperture of device A is an output aperture, while the other observer can assume that the aperture of device B is an input aperture, and predict the joint probability of A0 and B0 assuming this input-output structure. But mainly, another observer can predict the same joint probability distribution of A0 and B0, assuming a different input-output structure, for example, assuming that the aperture of device A is an input, and then basically assuming that A0 and B0 are two space-like separated. So in some sense, what I was saying is that indeed the two diagrams that I illustrated before can be thought as basically the same experiment seen by two different observers. Yes, please. Okay.
Space-like separated, mm-hmm. then I'm lost. Unless you're using space-like separated in some abstract sense, that means they can assume a kind of causal structure in which A and B are not causally directly related. This would be, but if we translate that into the normal space-time structure, mm-hmm. it would be something like saying we're assuming backward in time causation or something. I'm not sure exactly what the language would be. But yeah. You can't fiddle with, I mean, in an operational framework, you have a space-time in which these events are embedded, and you can't modify the space-time relationship.
Well, what my
either
result,
A and B are space-like separated, or they're not
yes.
space-like separated.
My result is that whenever you have a given set of correlated outcomes on devices A and B, two observers can calculate the joint probability distribution of this outcome. Assuming a different input-output structure and thus a different causal structure.
They could assume a different input-output
yeah.
structure and a different
and
causal structure.
And there is no point in
but
saying
they can't deny that A and B are in, with respect to the physical metric that we normally use, which is still there,
well,
that A and B are space
I think
separated.
That at this operational level, it is not defined what the metric of space-time is, basically. And you cannot define in an operational way what the metric is. And the point is that an operational definition of the metric, in my point of view, is to assign the labels to input to aperture. Yes.
So
you're talking
there's another way of saying it to say that the rules for correlations and probabilities of the readings on boxes and so on don't reflect where they might be positioned in some sort of space-time.
Yes, the rules of calculation of probabilities that are basically symmetric in saying that the devices on which they appear, the outcomes, are space-like separated or time-like separated, meaning that there is a causal inference from one device to the other. And this is what I'm going to prove in quite a detailed sketch in the what follows.
So if you were only to look at the different readings and the correlations and probabilities relating
yeah.
to them, then you wouldn't know whether
no.
this was
yes.
time
yes.
like
but yes, yes.
Yeah, this that's fine, but in a real operational experiment
yes.
setup, you have more information, that's all.
Well,
so that's not necessarily true. Like if you just have three boxes and you press, it's not necessarily clear that you know which one comes first.
The point.
Unless you make some extra measurements, which
yeah.
aren't normally made, in fact. So it's not so clear that what you're saying is correct.
The point, in my opinion, is that
close your eyes. I mean, if you limit yourself to just this information,
mm-hmm.
then I'm not climbing anything.
Well,
that's why I'm calling it.
Operationalism is about closing your eyes to stuff you don't see.
Sorry?
Operationalism is exactly about closing your eyes to things you don't see.
But you do see, them in the real world. You do.
Well,
when you set up an experiment like this, you have plenty of information that tells you about the cause.
But this information is.
But you can't put that in at the top because otherwise you're assuming what you're trying to derive. You're just trying to derive the causal structure, and therefore cannot put it in at the top.
That's fine. You can certainly ask, can I derive the causal structure from certain abstract data? But your claim is, I think, that you could not derive it. That's
yes,
your claim
indeed.
In the end.
If you.
That there's a sort of other formalism that gives the results, the probabilistic results, without the causal input. I think that's your claim.
No, my claim is that using...
Or there's a relativity, you have to choose the causal input as you like. You
yeah.
can choose the causal
yeah.
order as you like.
Yeah.
So it's not objectively
no.
given
yeah.
to you.
Yeah.
But I'm just saying this is not... Well, I... To
You're
me, it seems
that,
that it's not an operational... This is a sort of abstract operational framework, but it doesn't correspond... to what really happens in the laboratory.
Well, the point is that if you assume that there is some entangled first state of photons happening in some device, you are already using some quantum theory.
No, I understand that there's a motivation for, like Lucien has done with Causalite and so on, to think of a more general kind of framework. My only objection is that to call this operational in the laboratory sense...
Well, I call it operational because... I use
is
the
going,
methodology
this is
that,
really beyond normal sort of operationalism. I mean, maybe if you can give me a concrete, or Lucien can give an example, where you really don't have the causal ordering.
When you always have the causal ordering, this is the point. This is the fact. I think that this is the point. You always have causal ordering fixed in an absolute way, because this is what you use to assume in every physical process. But the new thing that I'm showing here is that the quantum formalism permits that causal ordering of events being regarded as relative to an observer. And this is the new result, basically.
Maybe if I ask a different
yeah.
kind of question. You're not suggesting that there is some sort of Lorentz boost between different observers? So they have these different perspectives.
Yeah, they basically assume just that there are two human beings assuming different input outputs.
Okay. So they're different observers in the sense they're just different people with different belief systems. Or something
yeah.
Like this.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Not different frames of references.
No. Not at all.
Okay.
Well, they can also have a different frame of references, but the main point is that they assume a different input output structure. So if you agree, I will go on with the proof of the result. Oops. From this was the main result, and what we learned from it is that since input-output structure is the causal structure of outcomes, we can state this principle of relativity of causal structure. That means that two observers of the same probabilistic quantum experiment can assume a different causal structure for the space-time events constituting random outcomes, and predict the same joint probability distribution. So where two different observers are merely distinct because they assume different input-output labels for the aperture of the devices. So here I'm going to give a quite detailed sketch of the proof of how it works. And the proof basically goes as follows. I will give now a brief outline, then I will go into the detail. Since in quantum theory, as you already suggested, we always assume that the causal ordering is fixed in an absolute way, then basically the mathematical object that we assign to the different parts of our operational diagrams are distinct for two observers that assume different input-output labels for the aperture. So what I'm going to do is to define the mathematical object that the observer assuming that the aperture of device A is an output aperture and the aperture of device B is an input aperture. Then I will show the mathematical object that the other observer assuming that the aperture of device A is an input aperture and the aperture of device B is an input aperture. Then I will state a transformation rule that is this rule. To pass from the mathematical object used by one observer to the mathematical object used by the other observers, And I will show that with this transformation rule, basically the two observers calculate the same joint probability for every pair of outcomes happening on A and B. And then I will show how to generalize this to more than two devices, basically showing a sketch of the proof only for the case of three devices. This is the sketch of the proof. So now let's go into the details of the proof. So the outcomes on device A are regarded as preparations, and thus on the set of outcomes X for this observer is regarded as a preparation ensemble, and this preparation ensemble is represented by a density matrix row that I, yes. Thank you.
Hockey stick.
Ah, yes, this. Thank you very much. And so this density matrix row here, and I write it here in this way, I decompose it here in this way with this set of positive operator here. Here, of course, A and X are the same set. So it's a mistake on the slide. Then we have that the ensemble row can evolve with the density matrix by means of a completely positive map T, the completely positive trace preserving map T. And basically, we can see the transformed density matrix T of rho as a bipartite, as an operator defined on the Hilbert space tensor product of the space of the system corresponding to device A and the system corresponding to device B. So I write here this operator that is basically that is the thing that is such that if we partial trace over Hilbert space of device A, will give the transformed density matrix T of rho, and this object inside this partial trace is what Leifner and Speckens in their quantum conditional state formalism call a causal joint state. And this set of operator here is what basically this observer associates to the set of outcomes Bj here. So this was the mathematical object for the first observer. Now, the mathematical object used by the other observer is basically the other observer assumed that the aperture of device A is an input, and as well as the aperture of device B, and then the correlations on A and B are originated by a generic normalized bipartite state of the two input systems here, and we call tau AB. And the two sets of outcomes X and Y are two measurement outcomes, and they are represented by a positive operator valued measurement, and we call them AI prime and BJ prime. And of course, they are these two POVMs are different from the one of the first observer, because of course the mathematical object that we are used to associate to calculate joint probabilities in quantum theory depends on the causal ordering. Now, I will state the transformation rule that permits to pass from the mathematical object seen by one observer to the mathematical object used by the other observer. And this transformation rule states that if a system S with an Hilbert space HS is an input for one observer and an output for the other observer, the operators involving HS used by one observer are the transpose on HS of those used by the other observer. And using this transformation rule, we can basically show that the two observers calculate the same joint probability for whatever pair of outcomes they appear on A and B. So we first define the operator T rho, and this was basically the object that we had here. So this T rho is basically that operator, and this is defined, of course, on the Hilbert space tensor product of the system passing through A and A and the system passing through B. And of course, T of rho, that is the evolved density matrix, is the partial trace over the Hilbert space associated to A of this of this operator, and of course this is the causal joint state of the quantum conditional state formalism. And for so the value of the probability of any two outcome, the joint probability of any two outcome A0 and B0 on device A and B is the trace over B of the POVM element BJ0 and multiplied by the trace over A of the of T rho multiplied by AA0. But now if we use our transformation rule, this tells that the bipartite state used by this observer is the partial trace over A of the operator T rho. And this tau IB is what Speckens and Leifner call an acausal joint state in their formalism, while the operator associated to the outcome A0, that is the POVM element AI0 prime, is basically the transpose of AI0, because of course AI0 is defined on the Hilbert space associated to A, and this is the Hilbert space that we change from input to output. And if we calculate the joint probability distribution of A0 and B0, according to this rule for the second observer, basically we have the same value of the probability of any two outcome A0 and B0. So this proves our statement in the case of two devices. Now, what if more devices? Yes, please. Yeah.
The output input causal structure, not the one that's shown here. In that case, it's possible to send a signal from side A to side B. You choose one setting. You can make it such that you choose one setting on side A, and the other side will get the same outcome.
You mean the signaling conditions?
I mean, it's possible to direct just a signal from A to B. So basically, if A sets zero.
Yes, this is because here you change. You can change the preparations here into a different density matrix rho.
Okay.
And so you can change the joint probability distribution. You can change the probability distribution here because you change the settings here, you are saying.
Right, but you can't signal in the other case.
Yes, in fact, you can signal because indeed this row here is changing to a row prime. And what you basically have is that in this case, you use a different bipartite state here. So the change in the correlations here are due to the fact that indeed you are changing the bipartite state here.
So you're saying that even though you can sort of signal in one case and not
in the other. Signaling and non-signaling are in some sense, this proved that, this can be used to prove that signaling and non-signaling conditions are not equivalent to assigning a given input-output structure and a given causal structure to the outcome.
Maybe I'm not sure if this is related. So I'm a bit confused of the logical stages of the transformation rule.
Yeah.
Is that an assumption you make, or is it something that sort of follows from some...
No, it's an assumption.
Right.
Yes.
What like motivation do you have? This is kind of the...
It's just a way to prove the concept that input-output structure is relative to an observer. Since the transposition rule, you have to transpose exactly on the space, on the Hilbert space that you change label from input to output. So it's just an ansatz that I did to prove the concept.
Mm-hmm. And how can we show that this like rule doesn't actually change something, say related to signaling? I mean.
Well, it's not related to signaling. I mean, the point is that what Lucien, I think, said is that if you change the settings here, then in this case, in the case when you assume here an output, if you change the settings here, then you affect the joint probability here. And but this means that you assume a different density operator here. So basically, in the other context, what the other observers see, if one changed something here, this is attributed to a change in the bipartite state here. So the probability it changes here because it is changing the bipartite state. This, I think that this was the...
Okay. So.
Yes, please.
I wonder if you can just clarify to what extent you've gone beyond the statement that there exists an isomorphism between the set of states that can hold in the case of output-input and the set of states that can hold in the case of input-input.
From the technical, from the mathematical point of view, this is the technical result. From the physical point of view, there is this idea that the transposition rule that you use to pass from one probability program probability rule to the other probability rule is basically a different change in the perspective of the input output labeling of your devices. And if you think in some sense to operational context, basically what you have is that you do not have any physical means to prove that in some sense the photons are going inside or outside a device. It's something that you merely assume. You cannot prove in any way. And this is basically, this fact is reflected in the mathematical, in the symmetry of the mathematical formalism of quantum theory. And this mathematical isomorphism can be basically the mathematical counterpart of this fact, that you cannot define what in a physical way, whether in a given, from a given device, systems go outside or inside. It's something that you just assume. So, I don't know if you are satisfied or not.
It answers my question.
Yeah, okay.
So, in your rule, you said you apply transpose to, but transpose is only defined relative to some choice of basis.
Of course.
So, what...
Whatever choice of basis you have transposed.
But is the choice of basis key to what device you think is supposed to be operated by? I mean, it can't be transposed with respect to all bases. Are you saying you pick a basis arbitrarily, or it's related
you
to the measurement
choose.
That A is supposed to do, or the preparation?
I think that you choose a basis to define your operator, and then with respect to that basis, you can always define a transposition. And
but then what if I choose a different basis?
Yes, it holds the same. Is basis independent? The transpose of an operator is always defined. It's not dependent on what basis used to.
No, it is dependent on what basis.
Well, the fact that it exists a transposition is not basis dependent. It's just take the operator, the basis of the operator, and make the transposition.
Then we have a mathematical disagreement.
Say is that the set of operators that you get by operating the partial transpose on, say, all the bipartite states, that set of operators is independent of which basis you choose to take the transpose in. So if you think
that
of...
set is independent. Because you did it for all possible...
For all, you were acting on all possible states.
Yes. But don't you have to have a map of a specific state to a specific state?
What matters is whether you prove you get the same probabilities in each case, not whether it's unique. Does this uniqueness question affect whether you get the same probabilities? Like, do you get, if you choose a different basis on the transpose?
Yeah.
Do you get different probabilities?
Yes. You have to choose. You have to assume a given causal, a given input-output structure.
Yeah.
You have to define the mathematical object, the basis, and the mathematical object with respect to that input-output structure.
Yeah.
And then, whenever you change the input-output structure, you accordingly with my transformation rule change the you transpose on the Hilbert spaces. Corresponding to that input-output spaces and basically see the same general probability.
I think the reason is that whenever you do this, if you do a transpose, you're also transposing in the space. Now, whenever you calculate something, you have a closed expression. Take the trace of a closed expression. if you're inserting a partial transpose in one space, you're also effectively inserting it in the dual space. So the overall calculation is the same.
Yeah.
Yeah. It does not
yeah.
So, yeah.
Yes.
No, I think you're only taking the partial transpose, right, as Lucien picked up. Now, if what you're doing only depends on the spectrum of that operator under the partial transpose, then that's invariant under local basis changes. That doesn't change under local basis changes.
Mm.
That's why it works as an entanglement test.
I don't understand, sorry.
Okay. If I have a density matrix,
yeah,
right, and I take a partial transpose of that density matrix,
yeah,
and I look at the spectrum.
No, I don't take this part, the partial transpose of the density matrix. I take the partial transpose of this operator. That
right,
is,
but it's still a Hermitian operator, right?
What?
It's still a Hermitian operator, yes?
Is a completely, is the, I don't know. It is this operator. Yes, it is this operator here. And this is the cross decomposition of the map.
Right, so that thing is Hermitian. Is that what you're saying?
I'm saying that basically, whenever you, what I'm saying, the result is that if you the rule that I gave to for this partial for this transpos for the transposition rule tells that if this this operator here means that there is an evolution of this of the state of the system here, and this is represented by this operator that is also this operator.
Okay. Is it Hermitian, yes or no?
What?
Is it Hermitian, yes or no?
Is it Hermitian? I don't know.
It's a CP map. Did you say it was a CP map?
Yes, of course.
So
it's Hermitian. Yes, of course. It's a, well, the partial trace over this space is Hermitian. I don't know if this bipartite operator here is Hermitian.
Right. So I mean, it depends on whether you're working in the original operator space or whether you're in the super operator space. If you're in super operator space, it's Hermitian.
Okay, yes, let's say that it's Hermitian. Yes.
Right, well, if it is Hermitian, then the rule still holds that if you take the partial transpose over one party,
mm-hmm.
right, you are free to make local basis changes, provided those are only local basis changes, not non-local ones, and that will leave the spectrum of that operator invariant.
Mm.
Right, the Horodetsky Perez, a partial transpose entanglement test would not work. That wasn't true.
Mm. So?
Right, so that gets you out of the objection of basis changes changing your transpose. Right, they don't change the key property, which was what this discussion.
Yes, I think that basis changing the operator. But here is that if you fix the basis and you basically associate the operator in this way according to the input output structure. If you fix the basis, then you can always do the transpose and obtain another object that is such that the disjoint probability is the same as this. And I don't understand your.
Okay, well, I'm trying to answer the Raphael's question that he asked earlier, right?
Okay.
So I'm actually trying to help you address Raphael's question, and we seem to be going round and round in circles here at this point.
Yeah, I'm not sure I understand. Maybe it's better that I end the talk and then.
Right, because otherwise I think Raphael's objection stands.
Okay, yes.
Maybe does this tau assume, using that language, is it a super operator, this tau?
This is the super operator.
Maybe it has, in some sense, four indices, and what you mean by transpose is just swapping two of the indices.
You take this and this operator, and you do the partial transposition over the inverse space of A.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So I know the next part of your talk involves more systems, but I feel like you can understand that the two system case will be doing well. So let me sort of ask a question, which is an invitation for you to sort of describe how this. Symmetry that you're arguing for works. So say we do an experiment with two qubits prepared in a singlet state,
mm-hmm.
and I say that it's two qubits prepared in a singlet state, and the two measurements are of z spin, x spin, or y spin on each side, but the same spin for both. And then I notice I always get anti-correlation of the outcomes.
Yeah.
Now somebody else says, no, I interpret it as one qubit that comes out of this device and going to the other.
Yeah.
And my response to them is, but hang on, a preparation measurement scenario, wherein if I prepared something in an eigenstate of z, x, or y, and then I measured it and I got the opposite eigenvalue,
yeah.
That is not a physical chant. So there are, you know, an identity map would have perfect correlations between the outcomes,
yeah.
But there's no net map that'll give me perfect anti-correlations for all those outcomes.
Well, because you have the partial transpose on one space. And the partial transpose, maybe in the singlet case, you have this, sorry.
So I see how it works with the mathematics, but here's, I'm asking you, what's your response? So I say, look, you know, we know what we're measuring,
yeah.
And we see anti-correlations, and that teaches us that these things are space-like separated, not time-like separated. And so I just want to know, like, in the language of just, you know, the correlations we've seen, what's your response to that?
I think that the fact that the there is an eigenstate of the spin observable is already a mathematical object that permits you to describe an outcome of on a device, and maybe you can always map the outcome like this in this way when you transpose, when you think that the aperture is not an output but an input. And then you can get the right answer here. I think that basically what you have is that an eigenstate is of an operator that is a spin operator that we do not basically understand in terms of classical physics, or and is something that results in the quantum formalism, is basically already a mathematical object that you assign to an outcome.
Okay, so if I understand you correctly, my opponent says, you misinterpreted that experiment,
yeah.
Because what you called, you know, z up as an outcome over here,
yeah.
You really should have called z down,
yeah.
And x up should have been called,
yeah.
X down.
Yeah.
So really what we're seeing is correlation, not anti-correlation,
yeah.
And systems are,
yeah.
Time-like separated.
Yeah.
Okay, now suppose I say, but the way these measurement devices were distributed is I took sort of one and the same measurement device and translated it over into space, and the labeling of the outcomes shouldn't have changed in that process. So,
it depends. Yes, it could be a point. I don't know, but I think that basically the same discussion holds also in that case, I think.
So my opponent would say, in that process.
I think your opponent might say, let's see if I can. Yeah. Might say we're not supposed to do that because we're only supposed to look at these particular probabilities and so on. But if we did that, then you'd have to tell another story, which involved all this process of transporting and so on, and then you might have to re-identify certain. I don't know
what
the opponent's supposed to say in that.
For one thing, your opponent might say, "Well, the thing that was an output in one case is now an input, so that changes how you should interpret,
yeah.
The functioning of this device." Perhaps you might say that. Does that make sense?
I didn't.
So the opponent might say, well, even if you take the two devices that are the same and you transport them, in one case, if you're in this context,
yeah.
Then in one case you're using this device with the aperture as an output,
yeah.
Whereas this device is being used,
yeah.
With the aperture as an input.
Of course.
And so they are characterized differently, and so you shouldn't identify the outcomes,
yes.
As Rob has suggested.
Yes, I think that could be a point. I have to think about it, and I don't know. Can I?
Yep.
So what if more devices are involved? Well, for example, we can have three devices, A, C, and B, and we can have someone assuming that these apertures here are three input apertures, and so we can, and if, in order to calculate the correlation A0, C0, and B0, this observer must use a tripartite and time state AWDC. But now, if another observer arrives and says, okay, this aperture of device C is indeed not an aperture but an input, is not an input but indeed an output, then what we see here is an evolution of the density matrix row. That is the object that represents this set of outcomes z by means of a given completely positive map t that is the evolution of from this state row to a state of the bipartite system, the bipartite input system here, And so the tripartite state A tau ABC is related to this object by our transposition rule of the aperture that has changed from input to output. So what we have is that we can claim that we have two foundational principles for quantum theory. This means that they can be used to motivate why the quantum the rules of quantum theory are the way they are, and I will speculate later, it can give some idea on how to move this idea to a cosmological domain. And so these principles are causality, what I call causality, and this means that the input-output structure of devices determines the causal structure of outcomes that happen on devices. And this is our operational definition of causal structure of outcome. And then we have this relativity of causal structure that says that two observers looking at the same quantum experiment, assuming a different causal structure, can become aware of differences in their respective probabilistic prediction. And so now I will briefly speculate about extending relativity of causal structure to universal principle. So a principle that does not merely is not merely related to the domain of quantum theory. So the laboratory with devices and quantum systems goes through the devices, but can be extended to a universe to describe the universe. In general relativity, so I will now briefly analyze the role of causal structure in general relativity. And the universe in general relativity is a manifold, and for any two points of this manifold that can represent events in the universe, A0 and B0, there can exist a space-like path between A0 and B0. And if this happened, then A0 and B0 are space-like separated, so no causal connection between A0 and B0 can exist. And if the path is time-like, then it can be that A0 and B0 are one the cause of the other. And if we translate this in equation, what determines the nature of the path is the vanishing of the covariant derivative here. And in order to write this equation, we might know the Levi-Civita connection, that is this expression here, and in order to know the Levi-Civita connection, we have to solve for the metric, the Einstein equation, that is the third equation here. And so what we have is that the nature of the path, being it space-like or time-like, is determined by the stress energy tensor representing the energy density in a portion of universe including A0 and B0. And what this tells is that the causal ordering of A0 and B0 depends on a physical observable, that is energy density, and this should have an objective measurable value. Now, so what we can say is that in quantum theory, as far as our consideration hold, of our consideration of the previous slide hold, the causal structure of events may be regarded as an observer-dependent property, while in general relativity, the causal structure of events is related via Einstein's equation to a physical objective quantity, and this gives rise to a unique metric tensor. And so this uniqueness basically tells you that the causal structure is an absolute property in general relativity. And so if we have this theory space that is something that of course, we have we can define in an abstract way. So put whatever you can think a physical theory is in this theory space. Then we have this border here, and this border separates the theories in which the causal structure is observer dependent from the theories in which the causal structure is absolute. And since we show that this part here is non-empty because we can find quantum theory here. But general relativity is on the opposite side of the border. And but this is what we expect from the theoretical point of view. But general relativity has problems, and these problems are in explaining observational data. And these problems are related to the existence of or the inference of dark energy. dark energy arises when we try to measure the curvature of space-time. And we have what I call two methods, at least two methods to measure the curvature of space-time. One is the direct method, and this consists in measuring energy density from direct observations of galaxies and clusters. And then we have what I call the indirect method, and this is measuring anisotropies of the cosmic microwave background. And what it turns out is that the indirect method leads to the conclusion that the universe is flat, so the curvature is one. And the direct method leads to the conclusion that energy density is only the 30% of the amount needed for the universe to be flat. So for this observation, the curvature must be less than one. And so we infer that we have a 70% of missing energy that we attribute to what we call dark energy. But now, since if we attribute in a natural way that this component of energy density is the vacuum energy of the quantum field that permeates all the universe, then we overestimate the missing energy for 120 orders of magnitude. That is quite a large amount, and this tells us that basically there is no point in understanding where this form of energy comes from. This is something like a parameter that we have to choose in order to this observation match. But so what we can tell is that from a more ignorant point of view, if we do not stare to the fact that we have a unique metric tensor, we can basically say that different measures of curvature give different answer, just because it is not possible to define a unique value of curvature of space-time, and thus a unique metric tensor, and thus an absolutely defined causal structure of events. And so what we have is that from this situation of the theory space, we can conjecture and we can speculate, and this is the last sentence I would say, that dark energy could be the signature that the theory of quantum gravity, or a theory that can be that can explain the existence of dark energy, could be searched in a region of theory space belonging to quantum theory, where the causal structure is an observer-dependent property. So this is my conclusions. Labeling as input or output the apertures of devices involved in a generic experiment is equivalent to assign a particular causal structure to the outcomes happening on devices. And two observers of the same experiment can assume different input-output labels and predict the same joint probabilities of outcomes. And the causal structure of the from these two points, we have that the causal structure of the outcomes in a generic experiment is not an absolute property, but is relative to an observer. And we may also conclude that extending this concept of relativity of causal structure to a cosmological domain could motivate why different methods for measuring the curvature of space-time do not give consistent answers, and maybe the consequent need to introduce dark energy. So I'm done. Thank you. Yeah.
So I do not quite understand what you wanted to say with this example, dark energy. I mean, well, first of all, these are classical measurements, and second...
What measurements, sorry?
Of the dark energy, they're classical. I mean,
yeah, of course.
So, I mean, there's no quantum there at all.
Well, the point is that this measuring of curvature give us different answers for the energy density and for the curvature. They do not match. And it's only because we are convinced that there exists a unique curvature that we need to introduce dark energy.
Mm-hmm. So you're saying that maybe there isn't any dark energy?
Yes, maybe that can be just a consequence of the model that we use to interpret the data.
I mean, there is another measurement, which is if you measure supernova and assume general relativity and homogeneity on large scale, then you have additional information that gives you.
Yes, and this evidence corroborates. This evidence corroborates the existence of some kind of dark energy.
Yeah.
But is not a proof of the existence of dark energy. I mean,
what would you consider a proof?
I don't know, but the main point was that maybe my speculation was that maybe the difference in the measuring of two, of the curvature of space-time could be related basically to the fact that there is no physical point to have a uniquely defined metric tensor and the uniquely defined curvature of space-time. And the fact that there exists this observation of supernova does not disprove my conjecture in some sense. This is what I wanted to say. Yes?
I mean, this is kind of to follow up on that. I mean, it seems quite a sort of strong claim then that you make, because in the quantum case, you say, okay, if I label one input-output or input-input, I use, you know, slightly different mathematical object to describe them, but I get the same kind of probability distributions.
Yeah.
Now you'd be saying, in terms of like the analogy, that
yes.
Essentially the curvature is somewhat dependent on how
yes.
I label it?
Yes.
I mean, I don't
Sorry. Maybe it is a big jump, sorry. What I told is the result that I proved is basically what you have said.
Mm-hmm.
Then what we can do is to interpret this fact and saying, okay, maybe the causal ordering of outcomes and of any event in space-time is not an absolute thing. It's basically relative to an observer, okay? And since the curvature and since the metric tensor is what determines the curvature, and the fact that we believe that is a unique curvature of space-time is that we believe that it exists a unique metric tensor for space-time, and this uniqueness implies that for any two events in space-time, we have basically that the function evaluated, the metric function evaluated at the space-time point is greater or equal to zero or is lower than zero, meaning that the two events can be either one the cause of the other or space-like separated. So, the fact of the curvature was I consider the curvature and the metric tensor because is what represents your causal ordering of events in space-time, basically. And the jump was relativity of causal structure means it is not physically justified the assumption that we have a unique metric tensor.
Are you trying to say that there coexist two different metrics?
Yes, or. Or many metrics, or we have to try to define other mathematical object to define our model of universe.
You mean in the sense of many world interpretation?
I really don't know. The speculation was just listing some facts and how this fact could be related to my principle. But they are very good question, and I don't know.
I'm still not quite clear on the sort of analogy. Is it then that you say the labels of input output is kind of analogous to what our metric is?
In some sense, yes.
Seem kind of vastly different types of things we're talking about. Yeah,
well,
and the causal structure you mentioned. I mean, in one case, you talk about sort of operators and measurements.
Yeah.
The other one we have, I think you had paths. I think you mean geodesics, essentially. I think there's a lot to be explained here to make this connection.
Of course, there is a lot. But the second part of my talk that was extending the principle, it was just a list of facts that lead to a speculation. And this was just a speculation and not something. I have to think about all these things that you are saying. Of course, you are right. There is a big difference in mathematics to describe one the object pertaining to quantum theory and those pertaining to general relativity. But of course, it may be a guiding principle to think about in finding explanation for dark energy. To think about of the fact that we may think that there is no point to assume that there is a unique curvature leading to an absolute causal ordering of events. So this was the speculation. Yes.
So in order for your relativity principle to work, it has to be the case that it's reasonable to interpret an object which looks like a mirror, according to one person, as a source of pairs of photons, according to another person. That if you actually sort of physically examine an object in a laboratory, you physically examine a mirror, you know, it sort of typically is a piece of glass with some silver paint on it. Whereas if you typically examine a source of photons, well then you know you have a laser with or some sort of you know some kind of source of light with you know like an entangled source of photons would be for example you have a laser pumping a crystal. So they just look very different.
So
it seems that you would have to sort of find a way to get around this to make them seem like you interpret one as the other, and that seems to be a big obstacle in this principle to me.
Yes. You are right. The point is that one should go in a lab and then see what are the physical object you are dealing with. And I'm not an experimentalist, so I don't know. Maybe you are right. And however, it always this your the point is that whenever you have a description of a given physical object, this description is entangled in some way with the theory that you have that
right.
described it,
yep.
And the point is that I don't know what is the fines where does the physical description end and start the theory that you use to model the physical object. So I think that this is a quite difficult task. In you are right, however, I suppose that there are different kind of physical object that do the two jobs in different in apparently different ways. But if you start at the mathematical formulas that and that the correlation that are the only things that you have in order to predict your result your result in your experiment, then this symmetry holds.
Yeah.
So two comments. One, the first is this reminds me a little bit. Story about electron-positron pairs.
Yeah.
So one observer could say,
yes,
electron-positron has been generated. The other observer says, no, there's an electron traveling backwards in time.
Yeah.
And starts traveling
this is an idea that I have, and I think that this symmetry, this relativity that I found in this very abstract operational language, may have some consequence on the different mathematical realization of what of quantum theory, and one mathematical realization of quantum theory is quantum field theory, of course, and the fact that we have positrons and antimatter in quantum field theory, it could be related to this symmetry that you devise at this abstract operational level, and so it could be that. Exploring the formalism of quantum field theory and the physical object that you have in quantum field theory, like antimatter and pair production, for example, it could be that you can, in some sense, explain some facts like antimatter and stuff like that in this way. But I did not know how to do this. It's just an idea. But you are right. Your observation is good, in some sense.
So the second comment is just a kind of a crazy idea that probably doesn't work, but so it follows a bit on Lucien's comment. So maybe it's not inconceivable that the crystal that you use to do down conversion is also something that could act as a mirror.
Yeah,
you know, so the crystal can reflect light. But I'm wondering if you could try to devise an experiment that such that the indistinguishability of these two causal pictures is not sort of an interpretational matter that theorists debate, but something that nature has to decide by virtue of deciding whether you can interfere those two possibilities or not. So I'm imagining you can set something up so you have a coherent superposition of two photons coming out of a down conversion crystal and one photon bouncing off that crystal, and try to set it up so that if there is no way of distinguishing them, then you get an interference effect. Whereas if there is a way of distinguishing them, you don't get the interference effect. And
yes, it could be very interesting to explore this possibility. Yes. I have to think. Yes, please.
I wanted to come back to Lucien's earlier comment about signaling. So can you repeat? I didn't understand exactly your answer to that.
Oh, sorry.
So
Oops.
If the person on side A has no choice over, if they have a choice, whatever that means.
Yes.
And in an operational framework, normally it's assumed that that has some meaning, although it
yes.
might. I'm not necessarily in favor of operational frameworks, but normally you do assume that that has a meaning. Someone, people
you
are
want
smiling.
To, you want to. So
maybe
you want to.
The case. But.
You wanted to.
No, I don't answer enough. I recover.
I don't
yeah.
answer.
Just can you repeat your answer? I didn't understand your
yes.
answer.
Yes. The point is that if you changing the settings here, if you have this picture, then correlations are signaling, meaning that if you change the settings here, then you have a change of probability distribution here,
mm-hmm.
right? And so these observers see, but what the other observers see is that. So this is the joint probability distribution that this observer calculate, okay? But the other observer here, if someone changed the density matrix here to a rho prime here, then you also change the bipartite state here, okay? And so the other observer see that this probability distribution is changed because there is a bipartite state here that is changed.
Well, right, so they would attribute it to a different cause. That's what you're saying.
What?
They would assign a different cause.
Yes, yes.
The two observers would assign a different cause.
Yes.
But suppose you had a situation in which A really was sending messages to B
by this situation.
Well, just in the ordinary sense of the word. So they were...
Like
you
know.
Internet.
Okay,
sorry.
Okay, yeah. I understand. Sorry, that's a stupid question.
I shouldn't say really was, but from the point of view of the observer that
yeah.
has output there and input here.
Yeah.
So messages were appearing, you know, were written on something, and then A was doing something, and the similar messages was appearing at side B.
Yeah.
Okay. So that makes sense to us as we in the normal story.
Yes.
But now you want to tell a different story.
Yeah.
So what do you say? That it's just an amazing, amazing coincidence that the same message happened to appear on side A and side B.
Well,
is that it's like what people call a conspiracy sometimes? Is that the?
I don't know. Maybe this is what you from a very pragmatic point of view. Quantum theory is a formalism that permits you to predict joint probabilities, and what I was trying to show here is that this can be done in there is some symmetry in the input-output labelings of the devices. Now the point is that I don't know whether this thing cannot be. Well, the point is that maybe it can be that what we understand as a causal influence is a mere perfect correlation of things. I don't know. Well, yes, probably it can be. And if you think about it, when you assign a causal influence, you are just compress the information in your mind about correlations that happens in real situation. I don't know if this answers your question.
I think the way you think about this operationally is you have a lever on A, right? So basically you've kind of been imagining boxes with lights on them. But if you want to talk about signaling, you want to have like a lever on A that lets you choose what message you want to send.
Yeah.
And then I think your response is, well, in one picture, the lever is on A,
mm-hmm.
but in the other picture, the lever is actually on this blue line.
Yes. The point is that acting with the liver here means that you are acting on this input system here.
Yeah.
And you can change the bipartite state of two systems by acting on this system here. So I don't know what is your, I don't understand the point.
You want to try?
Follow-up question? Yeah. Let me change the example slightly from people talking to, imagine you have sort of three galaxies and you know, you notice this flow of electromagnetic radiation from galaxy A down to galaxy C and a flow from C to B. And you know, so the first observer says, okay, the radiation going from C to A and to B, and when the radiation gets there, it has certain effects, and it causes certain things to happen. And you know, I describe it this way. And A and B are to the future of C. And now observer two says, no, you're wrong. A is to the past of C, and also you got the direction of time wrong. So you know, the things you're describing as the consequences of this electromagnetic radiation arriving and is actually, should be described in the reverse direction of time as this process whereby matter moves around and emits radiation into the future, which gets to C, and then moves on to B and has its effects. So there's you know, two changes. One, you know, whether B is to the past with the future, A is to the past with the future of C, and what the direction of time is. So if you put it that way, it sounds a lot like the kind of argument you're trying to make, and I think it's sort of just a generalization of things you said, but then it seems there are some sort of telltale clues for which is the correct direction of time. Like typically the correct direction of time is the one where, you know, there are light sources, there are collapsing spheres of light onto points, and you know, entropy increases, it doesn't decrease. And there's all these standard asymmetries of time that would give us some opportunity to say which of these two observers got it right when they described it. So I guess, do you agree that, you know, this arrow of time makes it difficult to tell this story outside the microscopic regime where you've been telling it? And to my example of galaxies?
It could be, yes. I really don't know. I have to think about it. And the point is that also the fact that the principle that entropy increases in with the arrow of time, this is what your point is, something derived from a picture in which we have a definite arrow of time. You know, I really cannot give a definite answer to your question. Maybe you are right. Maybe you have to think about it and see if this concept can be generalized in every possible branch of physics and not just merely being a mathematical symmetry of these things.
Well, a related practical question is, it's something that I'm always confused on myself, so I don't have a definite opinion on this, but normally it's assumed that non-signaling is a requirement, right? So if you come up with any modification of quantum mechanics or even maybe some reformulation of the original theory in which there is signaling, most people would say, okay, that's not valid. We don't like that. We don't think that that's likely to be physically correct in the end. Here, it seems that signaling, so what's your point of view on that? You would just say, we just throw that out? A requirement we should be maintaining, or should we just be assuming that the fact that quantum field theory in a certain interpretation with measurements and external observer, the fact that quantum field theory realizes this condition of non-signaling. It's interesting, but it's not fundamental, and basically we should be just as happy with any theory that has signaling. Is that your point of view?
I think that the requirement that I can tell you about the operational probabilistic approach and when they tell about no signaling condition, that does not mean that you have to you have a fixed causal. It's not equivalent of no signaling is not equivalent of having space like separated devices. Maybe I mean that you
so
can
what
have.
You mean? It's not defined unless you know whether the devices are space like separated. In order to even talk about the condition, you have to know when two devices are space-like separated. And then there's a condition of non-signaling. And we can ask, you can take the point of view that it's a meaningless condition.
Yes,
I
take that
formulated in general. Is that
I take that point of view that is not so meaningful.
I think perhaps we should wrap this up or continue it elsewhere. It looks like somebody else is coming to get into the room. But thanks again, Mark.